Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 22nd episode. Wild Trekker is a series of podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. This is the fifth episode of a seven-part series I call Dream World. This episode is devoted to the USA Trilogy, written in the late 1920s and early 1930s by the American novelist John Dos Passos. The trilogy consists of three novels, The 42nd Parallel, published in 1930, 1919, published in 1932, and The Big Money, published in 1933. The starting point of the USA Trilogy is given in a short introductory section. USA, writes Dos Passos, is the slice of a continent. USA is a group of holding companies, some aggregations of trade unions, a set of laws bound in calf, a radio network, a chain of moving picture theaters, a column of stock quotations rubbed out and written in by a Western Union boy on a blackboard, a public library full of old newspapers and dog-eared history books with protests scrawled on the margins in pencil. USA is the world's greatest river valley, fringed with mountains and hills. USA is a set of big-mouthed officials with too many bank accounts. USA is a lot of men buried in their uniforms in Arlington Cemetery. USA is the letters at the end of an address when you're away from home. USA is the speech of the people. The speech of the people is one of the defining characteristics of the USA trilogy. The vocabulary and slang and slurs and cadences and thought processes, the way characters express themselves. But the speech of the people is not just the way Dos Passos constructs dialogue. The speech of the people also calls to mind a political ideal, a dream fusing together a mythical proletarian America covering half a continent. The personal experience of Dos Passos, his reportage as a journalist, his socialist political convictions, his class consciousness, and also his hard and fast, cartoon-like either-or vision of reality, drawn in broad brushstrokes over 1,240 pages in the Library of America edition. I remember telling one of my writing classes at the State University of New York that narratives may be linear, like long pieces of string, going from A to B to C. They may be idealized, like a perfectly rounded sphere, or they may be multifaceted, like a sand rose, which is basically a riot of gypsum crystals facing every which way. I could apply the sand rose metaphor to the three novels Dos Passos pulls together into the USA trilogy. This is a sprawling work, something like 620,000 words long, spanning several decades of American life and telling every which way, in parallel, the story of 12 main characters, 6 male and 6 female, whose lives are told in 51 long chapters. There's no single point of view. There is, instead, more of a composite or collective point of view, reflecting the many facets of these 12 main characters. And given the first-person nature of the stream of consciousness passages, and the way some content is recycled from journalism Dos Passos had written previously, I can't help feeling the USA trilogy is part autobiography. Who are these characters? Mac is a would-be rabble-rouser who runs into trouble, drifts away from his family, and ends up in Mexico seeking revolutionary adventure. Janie Williams is a tired-looking, sharp-faced blonde who ends up as a diligent secretary to a public relations man in New York. J. Ward Morehouse is her boss, the personification of the get-rich-quick American huckster who believes all social and economic conflicts between capital and labor can be dealt with by effective communication. Eleanor Stoddard tries her hand at theatrical design, volunteers as an ambulance worker at the front in France during the First World War, is the steadfast platonic companion of J. Ward Morehouse, and eventually marries a Russian prince. Charlie Anderson is a mechanic who sides with the working class, then becomes a pilot in the First World War, returns to America to build aircraft engines and makes a lot of money, is responsible for his friend's death, sinks into alcohol, and dies of peritonitis. Joe Williams is Janie's brother, a wandering sailor who deserts from the U.S. Navy, ships out with the Merchant Marine, survives the sinking of his cargo ship in mid-Atlantic, never manages to settle down anywhere, and loses his life fighting over some woman in a bar. Richard Ellsworth Savage, also known as Dick Savage, is a Harvard-educated snob who's sanctioned for denouncing the First World War in a private letter, then is appointed captain, goes to Europe where he becomes friends with J. Ward Morehouse, works with him on public relations, and eventually gets embroiled in a sex scandal with 2 homosexual prostitutes. Evelyn Hutchins is a society lady who tries her hand at theatrical design with Eleanor Stoddard, goes from one lover to another, and goes from romantic enthusiasm about life's possibilities to cool bitterness. Daughter, or Anne Elizabeth Trent, is a brash tomboy from Texas, goes to Europe during the First World War to work for the Near East Relief, falls in love with Dick Savage, gets pregnant, and then, when Dick won't marry her, pressures a drunken airman to take her up in a flimsy aircraft, and she dies in the resulting crash. Ben Compton is a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, the so-called Wobblies, and as a conscientious objector and communist during the First World War, pays the price for his convictions. Eventually, he's expelled from the Communist Party. Mary French is an ambitious and idealistic middle-class young woman who sympathizes with the working class and ends up defending the anarchist cause célèbre of Sacco and Vanzetti, who are executed after a controversial trial in 1927. And then there's Margot Dowling. She's a child stage actress who is raped by her stepfather, marries an ineffectual Cuban, and when he dies, she becomes a major film star during the silent film period, although her career peters out once the talkies come in, because her voice sounds like the croaking of an old crow over the loudspeaker. This brings me to a first point about the USA trilogy. This is not a character-driven story. No matter how audacious his vision as a novelist, capable of pulling off a series of 3 novels, 620,000 words long, Dos Passos creates flat characters, bloodless, without emotion, and their America is a grim world of personal facts from which they can only escape by having alcoholic binges, random sex, including rape, and random abortions, in that order. This is surprising because earlier novels by Dos Passos, like Three Soldiers and Manhattan Transfer, are full of emotion. Now, what does it mean to live in a grim world of personal facts? It means that in the first novel, largely set before the First World War, and in the second, largely set in 1919, and in the third, largely set in the 1920s, the characterization is flat, told from the outside. Dos Passos sticks to what is happening, what is worth reporting. He bases his writing on events, not psychological perceptions, insights, or altered states. This gives a somewhat repetitive flavor to the storytelling, along the following lines. X character had a few drinks too many and wanted to have sex with Y character, although she managed, or didn't manage, to fend him off. Now, if you read the USA trilogy, made up of these three novels, The 42nd Parallel, 1919, and The Big Money, you won't find many dream scenes. Actually, I counted just a handful, and the dreams are all told in factual terms, without insight or evocative language. Dos Passos writes brilliantly about nature, and particularly about the movement of water, but these are not dreamy nature books. I can't help thinking Dos Passos is content to write about what is happening, what is worth reporting, the surface events of reality, because he also did a lot of journalism and must have known the common news values of journalism, such as conflict, controversy, disaster, death, deviance from the norm, impact, and prominence. Journalists are supposed to stick to the facts. They're not supposed to describe the inner struggles of their characters. This flatness of the characters in Dos Passos, as they claw their way through life in an utterly grim world, is intentional. It is also unfortunate. It means the reader misses out on emotions like love, hatred, envy, fear, anger, joy, sadness. There are never any emotional blowouts like in Dostoevsky. There's no charm either. The reader misses out on possible motivations, and can only assume the characters are alienated from their true selves, trapped in a capitalist American system where power is wielded by big industrial trusts who buy and sell politicians and control the labor force with aggressive private armies. This brings me to a second point about the trilogy. All the main characters are white. 11 are nominal Christians of Northern European descent, although Ben Compton is Jewish. So the grim industrial America of peacetime and wartime that Dos Passos portrays is actually white America. Black people, colored people, mulattoes, Native Indians, as well as other ethnic minorities referred to as WAPs, SPICs, YIDs, Bohunks, Polacks, and so forth, are no more than auxiliaries, phantoms in the shadows. They have roles to play, but their roles are definitely secondary, as waiters on table, girls to squeeze in smoky bars, prostitutes, whether female or male, brown Mexican ladies one of the main characters wants to sleep with. These other Americans have no real importance except as passive, dependent, subservient figures who make few demands and merely provide services or company to white people. This is astonishing because Dos Passos writes as a socialist. He believes he's writing about every man and every woman, and he made a name for himself in the 1930s as a proletarian novelist. Even though he came from a well-heeled Boston family, traveled widely in Europe, went to one of New England's top private schools, then studied at Harvard. So he came to socialism from a comfortable bourgeois upbringing, and this perspective filters through to the trilogy. I would like to come to a third point about the trilogy. Dos Passos writes a lot about social economic conditions. He has a very strong point of view. He's not writing art for art's sake. He's writing proletarian novels. His characters experience injustice over and over again. He breaks into the storyline, providing newsreel quotes from newspapers and speeches, and camera-eyed snippets of stream of consciousness and biographies of the ruling class in order to persuade the reader. For example, according to Dos Passos, the rich were getting richer, the poor were getting poorer, small farmers were being squeezed out, working men were working 12 hours a day for a bare living, profits were for the rich, the law was for the rich, the cops were for the rich. Then again, in the biography of J. Pierpont Morgan, Dos Passos gives a withering description of how big capital profits from the suffering of the people. Wars and panics on the stock exchange, machine gun fire and arson, bankruptcies, war loans, starvation, lice, cholera, and typhus. Good growing weather for the House of Morgan. More than that, Dick Savage writes to folks back home in blistering terms about the First World War. "You must understand how it is," he wrote the Thurlows. "I don't believe in Christianity anymore and can't argue from that standpoint. But you do, or at least Edwin does, and he ought to realize that in urging young men to go into this cockeyed, lunatic asylum of war, he's doing everything he can to undermine all the principles and ideals he most believes in. As the young fellow we had that talk with in Genoa that night said, it's not on the level. It's a dirty gold brick game put over by governments and politicians for their own selfish interests. It's crooked from A to Z. If it wasn't for the censorship, I could tell you things that would make you vomit." Dos Passos is telling the story of American industrial democracy, whether in peacetime or wartime, not in terms of professed values, but in terms of corporate interests. The workers are never wrong. They're always good-natured, hard done by, oppressed, exploited, and they're up against a brutal class of capitalists. So Dos Passos has a rhetorical purpose in mind. He wants to persuade the reader that every man and every woman in America are trapped in the capitalist system. He presents democracy as a smokescreen for big capital and politicians, by, for, and of gentlemen smoking cigars, and they cynically promote their own liberty, which is basically to run monopolies. Once America gets involved in the First World War, starting in 1917, it's the people, not the powerful, who actually fight at the front. The people are the cogs in the wheels of industry, and they're also cannon fodder on the battlefield. As one communist character, Ben Compton, says, "The capitalist governments are digging their own graves by driving their people to slaughter in a crazy, unnecessary war that nobody can benefit from except bankers and munition makers." Dos Passos conjures up the utter absurdity and futility of war. One of his biographical sketches, The Body of an American, is about the unknown soldier. It reads, "In the tar paper morgue at Chalon-sur-Marne, in the reek of chloride of lime and the dead, they picked out the pine box that held what was left, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, plenty other pine boxes stacked up there, containing what they'd scraped up of Richard Rowe and other person or persons unknown. How can you tell a guy's 100% when all you've got's a gunny sack full of bones, bronze buttons stamped with a screaming eagle, and a pair of roll puttees, and the gagging chloride and the puky dirt stench of the years-old dead? John Doe and Richard Rowe and other person or persons unknown, drilled, hiked, manual of arms, ate slum, learned to salute, to soldier, to loaf in the latrines, forbidden to smoke on deck, overseas guard duty, 40 men and 8 horses, short-arm inspection and the ping of shrapnel and the shrill bullets combing the air and the sorehead woodpeckers, the machine guns, mud cooties, gas masks, and the itch." Whew! Passages like this contextualize the anger and loss of faith of the main characters. Is there some way for them to recover what they've lost? One of the characters, Dick Savage, says, "I swear I'm ashamed of being a man. It will take some huge wave of hope, like a revolution, to make me feel any self-respect ever again." And now a fourth point about the trilogy. The USA trilogy has an either-or quality. Whenever representatives of big capital appear, they are class enemies, heartless, cigar-chomping power-mongers, calculating hypocrites who've mastered the game and always come out on top, no matter what happens. They are the quintessential self-serving backroom boys and hucksters advancing their own interests, corrupt, brutal in their wielding of power, opportunistic, parasitical. They are identified with the bad, new America, which has betrayed and oppressed the good old America. Whenever every man and every woman appear, they seem dignified, honorable, brave, hopeful, decent. They have their foibles, but ultimately they're identified with the good old America, the new and corrupt versus the old and dignified. This is an either-or representation of reality. It's also dreamlike. As Dos Passos says towards the end of the book, "America, our nation, has been beaten by strangers who've turned our language inside out, who have taken the clean words our fathers spoke and made them slimy and foul. Their hired men sit on the judge's bench. They sit back with their feet on the tables under the dome of the state house. They're ignorant of our beliefs. They have the dollars, the guns, the armed forces, the power plants. They've built the electric chair and hired the executioner to throw the switch. All right, we are two nations, America." In invoking the good old America, I wonder which America Dos Passos is referring to. Was there really a time, before the robber barons with their private armies in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when life in America was generally good, justice prevailed, and the people had a voice in the affairs of the nation? It depends which people Dos Passos is referring to. Perhaps he's thinking of Americans of Northern European origin who settled all over the country. Ever since the 18th century, the inexorable push westwards of the American nation involved mass deportations and genocide and slavery, subjecting millions of people to dislocation, degrading conditions, and murder. It doesn't seem realistic for Dos Passos dreamily to invoke the older America where people found their place and lived and worked together in harmony, but then he only writes in the USA trilogy about white America. Dos Passos became a best-selling author in the United States by promoting his brand of proletarian fiction. The United States was an easy country to criticize. Americans were allowed to criticize their country. But before writing the USA trilogy, Dos Passos also spent a few months in the Soviet Union in 1928, getting to know more about socialism there firsthand. In an article called Russian Visa, he gushes about the way Moscow is building socialism. He travels from place to place in the Soviet Union, viewing everything with the naive, uncritical eyes of a political tourist who doesn't know the languages and is there really to confirm what he believed before arriving. In 1928, Dos Passos wishes he'd experienced the outbreak of the Russian Revolution firsthand, 11 years earlier. He listens uncritically to Soviet workers expound on the objectives of communism. He contrasts the decadence of American theater with the way Russian theater is at the beginning of a period of tremendous growth. He dismisses what he hears about Stalin's Red Terror because the people telling him they feel terrorized and are worried they will disappear in the night are obviously still middle class. In a self-critical passage in Russian Visa, Dos Passos writes, "Well, you're a reporter, you tell yourself. You're gathering impressions. What the hell good are impressions? About as valuable as picture postal cards or the little souvenir knickknacks people who'd been on trips used to bring home to set in rows on the glass shelves of the parlor cabinet. Worthwhile writing is made of knowledge, feelings that have been trained into the muscles, sights, sounds, tastes, shudders that have been driven down into your bones by grim repetition, the modulations of the language you are trained to talk. It's silly to try to report impressions about Moscow. You can stay there and work, or you can go home and work." So, Dos Passos criticizes America, dismisses fears about Stalin's Red Terror, and indulges in self-criticism, all very politically correct from the Soviet point of view. But Dos Passos doesn't seem to have objected to the gulag system of forced labor camps under Lenin and Stalin, the erection of the Soviet police state, the catastrophes of the new economic plan, the man-made famine in the Ukraine and Stalin's campaign to destroy the kulaks, or wealthier peasantry. All of this was common knowledge at the time for anyone who cared to listen, but none of it put much of a dent in the thinking of Dos Passos. He only changed his mind about socialism because of the Spanish Civil War between 1936 and 1939, after the USA trilogy came out. Why does Dos Passos condemn capitalist monopolies and exploitation and remain silent about socialist monopolies and exploitation? I remember meeting someone in Moscow during the Cold War, and after a few glasses of vodka, he told me the following joke. "In capitalism, man exploits man. In communism, it is the exact opposite." Think about it. And then there's that emotional dimension fiction needs if it's to have much of an impact on us. We identify with the emotions of fictional characters. This is what draws us into narratives. Consider for a moment an iceberg, a very Canadian metaphor. Sometimes the conscious mind, what lies out in the open in our lives, makes up something like the 1/10 of the iceberg that bobs above the surface of the sea, whereas the unconscious mind, what lies out of view in our lives, makes up the 9/10 of the iceberg that looms below the surface. Dos Passos sticks to the 1/10 that lies in the open. He sticks to personal facts at the surface. Many other authors, for example, the magical realists of Latin America, zoom in on the 9/10 lying below the surface of their characters, which means exploring the psychological depths. Some people compare the USA trilogy, published in the early 1930s, with James Joyce's Ulysses, published in 1922. And they make this comparison on a technical level, since Ulysses incorporates bits of theatrical dialogue, poems, Catholic prayers, often in Latin, wordplay, back-and-forth banter, satires of newspaper articles, and political speeches, all of which can, in a way, be compared to Dos Passos and his blend of fictional narrative, newsreel segments, camera eye segments, and short biographies. We're all supposed to love the gods of literature, but James Joyce can be hard to take. The Dubliners is an early work of genius. A portrait of the artist as a young man is a poignant coming-of-age novel with extraordinary language. I will probably never get around to Finnegan's Wake. Turning to Ulysses in English, at a first level I'm dazzled by the disruptive wordplay, the stream, not to mention flood of consciousness, not actually Joyce's invention, but a technique he masters, the random associations and irony, and above all, the invention of a new idiom. And I just love his wit. Think you're escaping and run into yourself. Longest way round is the shortest way home. At a second level, Ulysses sometimes influenced me when writing my own debut novel, Mind the Gap. I'm intrigued by Joyce's mix of advertising, newspaper articles, puns, riddles, and references to the Odyssey, the inner monologues leaping from the first to the second to the third person like a cubist portrait showing a person both as he sees himself and as he's seen by many others, the endless Rabelaisian lists in the mock epic style, the music hall performances, and of course, the quotations from foreign languages. But at a deeper level, I have a hard time identifying with Joyce's either-or vision of life, swinging back and forth like a pendulum in perpetual motion. Ulysses is a saga of thwarted sexual drives against a background of all-embracing, all-smothering religion. Joyce is so hungry for recognition as an artist that he fills Ulysses with thousands of cryptic hints pointing to his own brilliance. The story sways this way, then that, between the margins and the center, self-neglect and self-absorption, whoring and holiness. Having said that, I'm fascinated by the music of language in Ulysses, a music rooted in the English language as it's spoken in Ireland, and in Joyce's own passion for singing. And it's clear that Ulysses is full of emotion. Joyce offers direct psychological insight into the characters, who have more depth. Joyce writes about the 9/10 of the iceberg that looms below the surface. Dos Passos presents us with flat characters, who react to stress and disappointment by smoking, getting drunk, or having sex, who live disjointed lives and are allowed to wander away from the consequences of their own actions. Once upon a time, Philip Graham, former publisher of the Washington Post, said journalism is the first draft of history. But journalism has also worked as the first draft of great literature. What I like best of all in the USA trilogy is what on the first few pages Dos Passos calls the American speech. He worked as a journalist and learned the methods of reporting. Writing a novel doesn't just require brain juice in an armchair somewhere. Journalism consists in writing down, recording, filming oral traditions or short oral expressions, which the journalist selects and arranges into a coherent whole or unity. And fiction, derived from journalism, uses some of the same methodology and materials. This is what Dos Passos has done with the 42nd Parallel, 1919, and The Big Money. I'm not sure the trilogy qualifies as an epic, because there are no heroic or legendary figures defying death and building new cities, as in the Epic of Gilgamesh. But the trilogy certainly is a compelling, complex, multifaceted work of the imagination, a work that springs out of a dream world. Even though the characters seem cartoon-like much of the time, like two-dimensional cardboard cutouts, the scope, the panoramic sweep of this trilogy makes it an exceptional work, a collective portrait of America in the early decades of the 20th century. Well, that's it for this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of this series of podcasts I call Dream World. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net, and that's Evidencia with an N as in November. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmeules on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2020, George Toombs. All rights reserved.